So we're coming this evening to start our time by looking at the fifth major teaching unit in Matthew's Gospel, the last of them. I keep saying the Gospel's built around these five major teaching units. And here is number five in chapters 24 and 25, which I've entitled The End of the Age or How to Wait for the King's Return. All of us, I guess, at some level or another have a desire to know the future. Such is people's desire to know the future that they are driven to all sorts of crazy measures, aren't they? Studying their horoscopes, or asking mediums and spiritists to consult the dead, reading tarot cards, gazing into crystal balls to know the future. I think sometimes we forget that listening to Jesus, we really can know the future. And in fact, the most important things about the future we can know with certainty. So there's an interesting conversation starter for you. Next time someone's quoting their horoscope, said, well, I know a thing or two about the future with much more certainty, and see where that conversation takes you. Well, here in this final major teaching unit, Jesus is talking to his disciples about the future. Of course, we need to recognize that from the perspective of the disciples at the time, the things that Jesus speaks of here were all future. Now for us, some of it lies in the past, some of it has taken place but will keep on being repeated, and some things are yet to take place. It's also true that, in the words of Don Carson, fewer chapters of the Bible have called forth more disagreement among interpreters than Matthew 24 and its parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21. So it's one of those chapters that people disagree over. And the problem really is that there are two big events in view in the chapter, as we'll see in a moment. At the end of chapter 23, as we saw last night, we find Jesus pronouncing judgment on the whole rotten system of first century Judaism. So we look at the end of chapter 23, and see how Jesus says to the Pharisees, the religious leaders he's just pronounced judgment on. He says, look, your house is left to you desolate. That's verse 38. The house in question being the temple that properly should be called God's house, but Jesus has disowned the temple and now says it's your house and it's desolate. It's an empty place. And those are the last public words of the Lord Jesus. And Matthew goes on to tell us in chapter 24 that Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. So we're at the start of chapter 24, if you're trying to find that. And so the disciples, you know, they're like the country boys in the city, impressed by the buildings that they find there, and the magnificent temple that had been built by Herod the Great, completed not that much earlier. And they're impressed by the buildings, and Jesus says, not one stone will be left on another. And we know that the words of Jesus were fulfilled in AD 70 at the climax of the Jewish war that broke out against the Romans in AD 66, led to a bitter siege and finally the fall of the city in AD 70. But of course, at the time, the disciples didn't know what we know. So they ask Jesus in verse 3, tell us, they said, when will this happen and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Notice that they ask about two things. They ask about the destruction of the temple on the one hand, and they ask about the coming of Jesus, which they associate with the coming, with the end of the age. So the struggle we have in this chapter is knowing when is Jesus talking about AD 70 and when is he talking about the end of the world. So these two great events in view, the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70 and the end of the existing Jewish order, and the return of Jesus at the end of this present world order. So which verses will refer to which event? Well, I want to say that the comfort for us is that I don't think it makes too much difference to the application, the conclusions that we reach about that. And the reason for that is that the end of the Jewish order prefigures the end of the world order. So that just as God judged the nation then and judged the city in AD 70, one day he will judge the world. And so lessons to be learned from AD 70 should be applied in the light of the judgment to come. So two Christians who study this chapter may not precisely agree with each other what refers to what, but we should actually derive the same instruction, the same warning, the same benefit, the same help, even if we differ on some of the details of interpretation. The application remains the same. So whether, you know, if we think something is about AD 70, well then we have to take the lessons from that and apply them to the judgment to come. If the verses are about the judgment to come, well then we need to apply them directly to ourselves. But one important thing I do think is that we need to recognise that Jesus is here correcting the wrong expectation of his disciples. It's very likely from the way that they phrase their question that for the disciples they view the destruction of the temple, the return of Jesus, and the end of this present age as a single, if complex, web of events. They are essentially expecting all these things to happen at once. But from their perspective, the end of the temple is such a massive event of such momentous significance that it surely means the end of the age. It surely means the end of this present world order. It must surely signal the final judgment and the establishment of the consummated kingdom with Jesus taking up his royal throne. So Jesus is needing to teach them to correct that perspective. He needs to extend their horizons and make them realize it's quite possible for there to be an extended period of time in between the destruction of the temple and the end of the age. That the judgment on Israel does not necessarily mean the end of all things. And so Jesus distinguishes in this teaching between things that must happen in a generation. We see that in verse 34. He says, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. So there are things that must happen within a generation, and those events certainly include the fall of Jerusalem. Interestingly, Jesus probably spoke these words around about AD 30. If so, the city fell 40 years later, which in biblical terms is a generation. Think of the time that Israel spends wandering in the wilderness until the entire generation that had left Egypt has perished in the desert and doesn't enter the promised land. That was a 40-year period. It's a period of a generation. So Jesus distinguishes between the things that must happen in a generation from the unknown day and the unknown hour in verse 36. A little bit unhelpfully, the NIV has missed out the word but that comes at the start of verse 36. So all these things, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. But, verse 36, no one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. So Jesus goes on, having spoken about the things that must happen in a generation, he goes on to speak of an event, the time of which is unknown even to him in his earthly ministry. And what is that event? Well, it seems from verse 37 to be the coming of the Son of Man. That's what he immediately goes on to speak about. And he speaks about the suddenness of that event when it's not expected. And it's significant that in the first three of the parables that follow, an important theme is the theme of delay. So you look at chapter 24 and verse 48. And in the middle of this parable, the wicked servant says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. Then in the next parable, chapter 25, verse 5, the bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. Then verse 19, after a long time, the master of those servants returned. So the theme of those parables is delay. And Jesus is preparing his disciples for a delay before he returns at an unknown time after the fall of Jerusalem. And the climax of this section comes at verse 31, which says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. But before that day comes, there is going to be this period of long delay. So it seems to me that it's reasonably clear that from chapter 24, verse 36, no one knows about that day or hour, that from that point on, Jesus is not talking about the fall of Jerusalem at all. He's talking about his focus from that point on is entirely on his disciples' readiness for his future return in glory at the end of the age as the end time judge. So what about the first 35 verses of chapter 24? Is it about the fall of Jerusalem or the end of the age or both? Well, I'm just going to tell you my view and then move on, rather than spending a long time justifying my view, because I think it's more helpful for us actually to move on to the application. I think the application is actually the more important thing. But just to give it you the way I read this chapter is that from verses 6 to 14, Jesus is talking about things that will happen before AD 70, but things that will keep on happening until he returns in glory. So they'll happen during that period up to AD 70, but they'll also keep on happening until he comes in glory. That in verses 15 to 22, he's specifically talking about the siege of Jerusalem ending in the destruction of the city. So that covers that unique historical period in verses 15 to 22. And then I reckon from verse 23 or so onwards, he's actually talking about his future return in glory, and that's excluded from the things that must happen within a generation. So there you are, there's my view. You can take that or you can leave that. But let's think about the applications, which is really the more important thing. It seems to me the first clear application is don't be deceived. You see, in verse 4, that's actually the very first thing that Jesus says in answer to the question that the disciples ask. So we're back in chapter 24 now, if you've lost track of where I am. Chapter 24, verse 4, he says, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Christ. And see how he mentions that again in verse 11. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. And then he comes back to it again at verse 23. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. So it seems to me a big message is don't be deceived. Jesus warns that many false prophets will appear and deceive many. So watch out. Don't be gullible. Test what they say. Test against the word of God. Don't be taken in. Don't be taken in even if they perform miracles. That itself is no proof that they are a true prophet. Be on your guard against miracle workers who claim to have fresh revelation for the church or who make great claims about themselves. Especially ignore anyone who says, here is the Christ, or there he is, that he has returned in secret, and I can tell you about him. Such people will appear, especially in times of crisis, but don't be taken in. Who knows, maybe in our lifetimes there will even be some messianic figure who claims to be the Christ and who performs great signs and miracles, who draws after them a following of tens of millions or even hundreds of millions. Who knows? That is possible. But if anyone says, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. Because when the real Christ returns, you won't need anyone to tell you. I take it that's the point of him saying in verse 27, that as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. It will be such an unmistakable event, you won't need anyone to tell you, which is why you're perfectly safe ignoring all the people who claim to be the Christ or claim to be his prophet. So don't be deceived. Secondly, don't be alarmed. Don't be alarmed at the crises in the world, first of all. Jesus tells his disciples in verses 6 to 8. So he says, you will hear of wars and rumours of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. And of course, such things have been happening in the world ever since. And Jesus says that they must happen. That they are characteristic of a world which is under judgment and which is heading towards God's great day of reckoning. But you will always find someone ready to tell you that the world is getting much, much worse, isn't it? And the end must be very close. Don't you think that? They'll say. But that's to draw the wrong conclusion from these signs. They are only signs of the end in the broadest or loosest sense. So Jesus uses the illustration of childbirth, that when a woman who is with child feels the first birth pains, she knows that the birth of the child is coming, but she doesn't know when it will be. It's one of those completely unknown things, isn't it? For some, the labour is extremely short, and for some, it's extremely prolonged. I'm glad that for me it's neither. But no one knows. So using that analogy, Jesus tells us that the crises in the world are only the beginning of birth pains. So every war, every unrest, every natural disaster is a sign that the end is coming. But they tell us nothing about the timing of the end. They are just reminders that this is a world under judgment, heading towards a day of judgment. And many times people in the past have had a premature expectation that the end is coming because the crisis is so acute. In the Middle Ages, there was a period when one-third of Europe's population was wiped out by plague and famine. Naturally, people thought the end of the world was nigh. But of course it wasn't. We're still here, aren't we? So we are, of course, to be enthusiastic for the Lord's return, but we're not to be provoked by events into a premature and unsettling expectancy. We're not to be panicked by events into foolish actions because we've become convinced the Lord is about to return. Keep a cool head, says Jesus. Don't be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Third application is don't fall away. That's the implicit message of verses 9 to 13. Because there will be times of terrible crisis for the church. We've seen the crisis in the world that might make us think that Jesus must be returning very soon. Here are the crises in the church which may make us fall away. So verse 9, you'll be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. And you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. So Jesus warns us that there'll be times when the persecution and the martyrdom of disciples will escalate. There will be times when apostasy, that is people turning away from the faith, and betrayal and hatred will run wild in the church. We can see both in the world today, can't we? In some parts of the world, it is violent persecution. And the reality is that in the 20th century, there were more Christian martyrs than in all the previous centuries put together. For us, it's not so much about violent persecution, we don't experience that, but our experience is people turning away from the faith. 80,000 people a year leaving the church in Britain, that was the figure. The love of many growing cold. And we do see false prophets in the church. And we see the vitriol, the hatred, the animosity that is turned against those who preach the truth, such that we do feel there is persecution coming on the horizon. Of course, it's not all bad. The gospel of the kingdom is being preached to the nations in an unprecedented way. But nonetheless, these are times of great pressure on ordinary Christian people. And Jesus tells us that we need to stand firm. He who stands firm to the end will be saved, he says. Keep on standing firm in faith and in love to the end of your life or to the end of the age, whichever comes first. Don't fall away. Times of crisis in the church call for perseverance, standing firm in the gospel armour that God gives us and in the strength the Lord supplies. Salvation awaits those who stand firm. So don't be deceived as you wait for the King's return. Don't be alarmed as you wait for the King's return. Don't fall away as you wait for the King's return. And fourthly, be ready. I think that's the lesson that we can learn from the words of Jesus about the fall of Jerusalem that follow at verse 15. Onwards, Jesus tells his disciples about what is going to happen to that city so that they could be ready, so that they would be ready to flee the judgment on Jerusalem without hesitation. And according to the early Christian historians, that's what the Jewish Christians did. That as the Roman armies approached the city, that the Jews, on the whole, fled into the city for safety. But the Jewish Christians fled from the city because they knew from the words of Jesus what was going to happen. And so they escaped the judgment on the city. And just as the Jewish Christians needed to be ready for the fall of Jerusalem and the end of that whole old order of Judaism, so we need to be ready for the return of Christ and the end of this whole present world order. And that's the lesson that Jesus tells us to learn. So going down to verse 32. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. So on a fig tree, the leaves coming out is a sign of summer. In the same way, all the things that we've just considered, the last 2,000 years of crisis in the world, the last 2,000 years of crisis in the church, the particular event of the fall of Jerusalem, all of those things happening are signs that the return of Christ is near. And so, as we read of Jesus saying that these things would happen within a generation, we know his words were fulfilled. That generation did witness and experience all of these things, because soon after AD 30, the peace which had prevailed in the Roman Empire disintegrated. And there were wars and rumours of wars. And there were famines and earthquakes. We actually read a reference to one of those famines in the book of Acts, don't we? And also in the book of Acts, we see how persecution dogged the believers' footsteps. In a letter like 1 Corinthians, we see how internal dissensions tore the church apart from within. In the New Testament letters, we see that there were false prophets and there were perversions of Christianity and so on. And we also read of Paul in Romans chapter 10, writing by the late 50s AD, saying that the gospel had gone to all the known world. and finally Jerusalem fell in AD 70. In other words, everything that Jesus said would happen before his return did happen within a generation, which is why every subsequent generation of Christians has been able to believe that Jesus could return at any time, within their own lifetime perhaps. Because there's nothing that Jesus has spoken of here that hasn't now already happened at least once. The fig tree is in leaf. Summer is near. So be ready. Of course, above all, being ready means putting our faith in Christ. It means putting ourselves under his loving rule. This world will come to an end. It's ever so hard to believe it, isn't it? Because everything just seems to go on day by day, week by week, year by year, as it has from the beginning. Very hard to believe it will come to an end. But it will. His words will not fail. The end is coming. And the day of his return will be a day of judgment. And we need to flee the judgment just as the Jewish Christians fled from Jerusalem. But how do you flee the judgment? Well, paradoxically, you flee the judgment by fleeing to the judge. You flee to Christ. So Jesus says in verse 30 that when he returns, the nations of the earth will mourn as they look upon the one they have rejected coming in power and great glory, and they will face him as judge. But those who belong to him, the elect who have put their faith in him, well, verse 31, they will be gathered by his angels from the nations, from the four points of the compass, they'll be gathered into his kingdom. So those who belong to Jesus are safe on that day. And the foundation for readiness for that day is faith in Christ. But Jesus goes on to tell us five parables that show us what the readiness of faith looks like. What does it mean to be ready? Well, five parables about readiness. The first one, verses 43 and 44, it is the parable of the homeowner and the thief in the night. The warning of that parable is that his coming will be a sudden event, so be ready at all times. You know, I had a delivery today, and I got a message by email yesterday saying it was coming today. Then I got an email this morning telling me when it was coming, what time of day. I got a text message telling me what time of day it was. I was told I could go onto a website and I could track the delivery man as he journeyed around Sussex, got to Haywards Heath. I knew when that delivery was coming, but not the thief doesn't do that, does he? The thief doesn't do that. The thief comes when you don't expect him. Without warning, the Son of Man will come in that way, says Jesus. So the readiness of faith has to be a constant readiness. Always ready, because you don't know when he will come. Then in the second parable, it's the parable of the faithful and wicked servants, where the warning is that long delay may lead to selfish and faithless behaviour. This parable seems to be addressed to church leaders especially. And Jesus warns that those who abuse their position within the household of the church, those who fail in their duties and exploit others and indulge themselves instead of doing what they're called to do, will face judgment. Jesus talks of them being cast into a justly deserved eternal judgment, which demonstrates that they never really were his servants in the first place. If they really were his servants, they wouldn't have behaved in that manner. So the readiness of faith involves demonstrating the reality of our faith by diligently fulfilling whatever responsibilities we are given in the household of God. Then the third parable, the parable of the wise and foolish bridesmaids, the warning here is that I put on the handout, the unexpectedly long delay may lead to carelessness. I think it's probably better to say it will expose carelessness. And the long delay will expose lack of preparation. So this parable uses the picture of a Middle Eastern wedding where the bridegroom comes at night to collect his bride and celebrate the wedding banquet. And the disciples, the bridegroom is clearly Jesus, and the disciples are pictured as the unmarried young women who have the task of lighting the way in the darkness for the bridegroom coming to his bride. And there are 10 virgins, and they are identified either as wise or foolish. And the key difference is that the wise virgins have come with some spare extra oil, so that from the beginning they are ready for the possibility that the bridegroom may be later than expected. The foolish virgins have brought their lamps, but they have no extra oil. And so when the bridegroom comes, they run out of oil. So I think this is teaching us that the readiness of faith starts out ready to endure faithfully for the long haul, however long the delay is before Jesus returns. That as we set out in the Christian lives, on the Christian life, we must be ready to persevere for a long time. Don't embark upon the Christian life thinking, well, I'll be able to cope with this for 3 or 4 years. I do hope that Jesus comes by then, because I'm not sure I can manage more than that. Now be ready for the long haul from the beginning. Set yourself up for that. You don't know how long you're going to have to live the Christian life. Parable 4, the parable of the talents. Well, here the warning is, don't fail to use whatever the master has given you in his service. So here in this parable, Jesus is pictured as entrusting the wealth of his kingdom to his disciples as stewards who are to invest that wealth on his behalf. Now, it's slightly unfortunate that this word talents, because, you know, we think Britain's got talent, don't we? It's not that. A talent was actually a large sum of money. So it's the investment of wealth, of treasure. What does that mean? What treasure has he given us? Well, it must represent the gifts of the Spirit that he gives to his disciples to do the work of the kingdom, the valuable gospel message itself that's been entrusted to us, and whatever gospel opportunities present themselves. And the readiness of faith will show itself in using whatever gifts we've been given to build up the church, speaking the gospel message, both within the church and outside of it, and making the most of every gospel opportunity. We're to use what Christ has given us in gospel terms in his service. And he doesn't expect more of us than we are capable of. Notice in verse 15 that he gives to each one according to his ability. So he doesn't demand of us more than we are capable of. But what we're able to do, and what he's given us to invest in his kingdom, well, we're to use it and put it to work. And then we come to the final parable, the parable of the sheep and the goats, which isn't really a parable properly. Rather, it's a depiction of the final judgment, which makes a comparison at the beginning with the act of a shepherd separating sheep from goats. And this parable, or this final section, tells us that Jesus on the last day will be the judge. It tells us that all nations will be judged, and that the outcome will be heaven or hell. And the basis of the judgment is what we've done for Jesus. And the key verse here is verse 40, where Jesus says to those who are ushered into his kingdom that whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. And it's important that we rightly understand that phrase, these brothers of mine. The word brothers must refer in Matthew's Gospel to those who are disciples of Jesus who do the will of the Father. Do you remember the end of chapter 12? Where Jesus is gathered in the house with his disciples and his natural mother and brothers come asking to see him, and he says, well, these are my mother and my brothers, those who do the will of my Father, those who are listening to his teaching and putting it into practice. So these brothers are mine, are his disciples. In verse 45 here, he also refers to them as the least of these, which reminds us of the little ones language of chapter 18. And just flip back with me to chapter 10, verse 42. Right. Where Jesus uses the phrase, one of these little ones. Let's just pick it up at verse 40. Remember, this is the end of the mission briefing. So the chapter 10 is all about the disciples of Jesus being sent out on mission. Verse 40, he says, he who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. Anyone who receives a prophet because he is a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. And anyone who receives a righteous man because he is a righteous man will receive a righteous man's reward. And if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones, because he is my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. So I think that verse 42 confirms that in chapter 25, Jesus is talking about his disciples. So the good deeds in view at the judgment are good deeds done for other disciples in need. That is to say, the sheep demonstrate that they are true subjects of the kingdom by caring for his fellow disciples, or their fellow disciples. So as Artie Franz puts it, good deeds done to Jesus' followers, even the least of them, are not only works of compassion and morality, but reflect where people stand in relation to the kingdom and to Jesus himself. So what's the acid test here of how you actually relate to Jesus? Well, it's how you treat your fellow disciples. And I think it's worth noting that the context in chapter 10 is where we get this phrasing about giving a cup of water, which recurs in chapter 25, that the context is disciples on mission in a hostile world, where they face hostility and persecution. So here, in chapter 25, the readiness of faith, which is readiness for that day of judgment, shows itself in active love for Christian brothers and sisters, especially those who endure persecution for Christ. See, Jesus says here in chapter 25, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. Why especially might Christian disciples be in that sort of condition? Well, because they've been enduring persecution for Christ, or they have been bearing sacrifice in his service. And the love that we show for those who endure persecution for Christ and who have borne sacrifice in his service is the demonstration that we truly belong to him. So readiness in all of these ways, not least the readiness of showing active love to Christian brothers and sisters in need. That's taken us to the end of chapter 25, which is the natural point for us to take a break. Any questions? As we pause there, yeah.
I have never thought when he talked about the least of these of visiting people.
Yes.
He was only talking about Christians and Christian disciples.
Mm.
So everybody and anybody who is in trouble or needs help.
Yes, of course, that is not saying that we don't help those who are not Christians.
But that doesn't seem to count.
Well, the question, you see, the question on the last day will be, do we belong to Jesus? Yeah? And Jesus says here that one of the tests of whether we truly belong to him is how we treat his disciples because they are his disciples. And it is, if we take it that the people here in need is just anybody in need, then you end up where that takes many people is down the line of saying, well, on that last day, anybody who has done good to people in need, they will get into heaven because they've been doing good. But because it's not doing good that gets us into heaven, because we are all sinners who deserve hell.
Yes.
And it is belonging to Jesus and having faith in him,
yes,
that will get us into heaven.
Yes.
And how we respond to other people as disciples reflects our attitude to Jesus.
Yeah. Coming from India, I find that extremely difficult.
Well, I think this is not saying, of course, you know, don't do good to other people. But I think especially, you see, in a, if when you imagine the context of people experiencing persecution for Christ, and they're living in a whole society that is actually turning against them, whether you will express your solidarity with those disciples of Jesus who are the objects of persecution is actually quite an acute test of whether you are truly loyal to Jesus.
Yes. One does.
Yes.
But
yeah.
Does one not do anything for anybody else?
No, I'm not saying that, am I? I keep saying this does not mean don't do good for other people. What I'm saying is, in interpreting what this passage means, that all of the language, that who are the brothers of Jesus? Yeah. In Matthew's gospel, they are disciples. And the very same language of looking after people links back to chapter 10 and receiving people there who are disciples. And it is, that's probably all I can say helpfully on that one at this point. You can consult the commentaries like Don Carson's commentary or R.T. Francis' commentary. They take you through the detailed interpretation here.
Yeah. It's a good question,
it is a good question, yes. Yeah, yeah. But this is actually the classic sort of liberal text for saying basically you get into heaven by doing good deeds to the poor. Which is not, of course, to say that doing good deeds to the poor is not an important thing, but that's not what gets us into heaven. We end up.
In either case, it's faith in God.
It is faith, yes, yes.
Yeah. Salvation.
Yeah. Yeah. But you see, if you say these are not disciples, then it actually eliminates these people who are getting into the kingdom. You've eliminated the aspect of relationship with Jesus. Yeah? See, that's gone from it. So the liberal interpretation is, well, Jesus was poor and homeless. So Jesus identifies with the poor and homeless. So he calls them brothers. So anybody who helps the poor and homeless will get into the kingdom. And irrespective of what they think of Jesus. But what we think of Jesus is the ultimate question. And so that's the problem. Once you lose that connection that these people here that are being helped because they belong to Jesus, and my motivation in helping them is actually because they are fellow disciples. I'm loving, you know. So love is quite a complex thing. You can love all people, but you love your own family in a different way. And I can love all people in need. Because and see their need and have compassion for them and want to respond, but there should be a different quality of love that I have for fellow Christians because they belong to the family of Jesus. Yeah, does that help?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, fine. Right way of saying it. Okay.